From NPR News, you're listening to the best of Weekends on All Things Considered. I'm Guy Raz, the host of the program on Saturdays and Sundays. This episode, 1989 all over again in the Middle East. Try 1848. Also, the Near Revolution on a West Virginia mountain in 1921 and why the battle isn't over. Plus, the Amish Bernie Madoff and lamenting the lost art of pickpocketing. And why the beautiful people are heading to Miami to listen to heart-pounding drum and bass in the next few days. That's all in this episode of Weekends on All Things Considered.
It's 1968 all over again.
Although I would remember, though, in
1979.
I
remember what happened. 1989.
1989, the year the Soviet Empire fell apart. The speed and drama of what happened that year looks a lot like 2011 in the Middle East. But there's another year to consider, 1848. And it was that year when Europe witnessed the largest and most sustained wave of revolutions in world history.
My name is Jonathan Sperber, and I'm the curator's professor of history here at the University of Missouri.
Jonathan Sperber's been thinking a lot about the protests in the Middle East lately. He normally spends more time thinking about the 19th century, but he can't help but see the parallels between 1848 and 2011.
Everyone's heard of the potato famine in Ireland that affected all of Europe. Food prices were very high and was followed by a recession in 1847.
High food prices, a bad economy, an entrenched, entitled ruling class, corrupt monarchs, limited social mobility, government-sponsored thugs on the streets, and then you had the rise of newspapers, so information could move from Budapest to Brussels in a matter of hours.
All sorts of things going on that had created this increasing mood that something would have to change in Europe.
And as in Tunisia, a single protest sparked a wildfire.
It starts with a rising in the city of Naples in southern Italy in January of 1848.
The unrest soon spread to a much larger, much more influential country at the time.
The big event is what happens in France, in Paris.
The demand for reform and more accountable government swept through the cities of France.
In 3 days of street fighting at the end of February, the monarchy is overthrown and the republic is proclaimed. In 1848, to proclaim a republic meant to proclaim yourself, well, radical.
Now, word traveled fast. This is the beginning of the golden era of rail travel. So in Berlin, trains from Paris would arrive daily.
People hung around the railroad station waiting for the latest news from France.
The idea that revolutions could occur in France gave Germans and then other Europeans confidence to try the same thing.
That's exactly what happened.
The uprising spread all over Europe.
Major cities like Berlin, Vienna, Budapest, Milan, riots, demonstrations in Prussia, Austria, Hungary, Denmark, Germany, Italy, and very obscure places like the Danubian principalities of Moldavia and Wallachia, Italian possessions of the Habsburg monarchy. Everywhere, it's the single largest wave of revolution in European history.
New governments were established all over Europe, but they didn't last. And within a couple of years, most of the revolutions were defeated and counter-revolutionary forces returned to power. It seemed the status quo was back.
But when we look ahead a quarter of a century, by the 1870s, there are constitutional governments everywhere in Europe except for the Tsar's empire. And in France, there is, in fact, in the 1870s, once again a republic. So in the short run, the revolutions are unsuccessful. In the long run, rather more than one might think. I really hope that it won't take a quarter of a century for revolutionary change to reach the Middle East.
That's historian Jonathan Sperber from the University of Missouri. He spoke to us from the studios of KBIA in Columbia, Missouri. French geopolitical scholar Dominique Moissy has been following the events in Libya closely, and he says from a European perspective, the crisis is somewhat more complicated.
For Europeans, what's happening in the Middle East is very close to us. Geographically and historically. On top of it, we have specific responsibilities vis-a-vis migrants, for example. So in a way, we are more concerned than the United States. And at the same time, it's more difficult for us to act.
Let me ask you about the role of diplomacy here. You've recently written that one of the limitations of the diplomat posted overseas is that normally, they can't really make contact with what you call alternative sources. Can you explain what you mean?
Well, I think classical diplomacies are emphasizing the fact that international relations are the relations between state. And in fact, very often, one discourages the attempt by diplomats to get in touch with the opposition, with civil society, with alternative source of information. But by doing so, you run the risk of reproducing the propaganda of a regime that has lost all legitimacy in the eyes of its citizens.
One of the interesting observations that came out after the WikiLeaks cables started to be released was how accurate many of those diplomatic cables actually were and how they really did reflect a range of views from the countries where they were written.
I think that is very true, and it would be very interesting to have WikiLeaks relating to European diplomacies.
Of course, WikiLeaks was only about American.
Exactly.
State Department cables.
But most often, they don't derive the necessary conclusion.
In other words, you're saying that, for example, in the case of Libya, many of them wrote things that would indicate that change was coming, but they didn't necessarily emphasize that.
Yes, they didn't dare to say all despots are not alike. What we've been saying about Gaddafi in the last 4 or 5 years, the man has changed, he's become more moderate, and now we are confronted. He's as mad as we ever thought he was. But simply because we felt the need to engage with Gaddafi after the war in Iraq, after 9/11, we declared him much more rational than he was in reality.
Earlier we heard about 1848, and of course most of those revolutions were crushed, and at least initially it seemed like not a whole lot was going to change. Do you think what is happening now in the Middle East and in North Africa is irreversible, or do you think that this may be a temporary series of events that ultimately will lead to no major changes?
What's happening in the Middle East today is a revolution in the deep sense of the term. What I do not know is the calendar of change. It's a long process that is opening in front of our eyes. Some things will never be the same as before. This is the true nature of a revolution.
That's Dominique Moisy. He is a senior advisor at the French Institute for International Relations in Paris, and the author of the book, The Geopolitics of Emotion. He spoke with me from his home in Paris. Dominique Moisy, thank you.
Thank you.
What's happening in Wisconsin may be a big turning point for organized labor in America. It's not yet clear whether Governor Scott Walker's plan to end state workers' collective bargaining power will destroy the unions in his state or whether it'll actually re-energize them, both in Wisconsin and nationally. What is clear is that we're all spectators in a pretty significant chapter of history, the history of organized labor in America. And recently, we went to a place that can probably be described as a kind of Bastille or Lexington and Concord of that history. It's called Blair Mountain, and it's located in a southern pocket of West Virginia.
15 years in the coal mines, but ain't a very long time.
And in late summer 1921, Blair Mountain was the site of the largest uprising in American history since the Civil War, and the only time in history that U.S. air power has been used against American civilians.
This is what's left of town of Blair. There's probably maybe, I think I counted 35 houses left.
We meet Kenny King alongside the stream that passes through what's left of Blair, West Virginia. He's a third-generation coal man. His grandfather and father were miners. Kenny works as a chemical analyst for a coal company. And here in Blair, Logan County, West Virginia, well, this is the heart of coal country.
It's been underground mined a lot, but there's still, you know, still quite a bit of coal left. Yeah, there's millions of tons, I'd say, in this area.
I'm just an old coal miner, and I labor for my bread. This story in my memory I've here told.
West Virginia has been called the Saudi Arabia of coal. It produces more than a third of all the coal mined in the U.S., and more than half the energy we use is powered by burning those black rocks. The lights in your house, your TV, maybe the radio you're hearing this story on, they all work thanks to coal. The other thing about West Virginia is its poverty rate, one of the highest in America, even though coal prices just hit a 15-year high. Almost a quarter of the people in this county, Logan, live below the poverty level. People left behind by the changes in technology and technique that have allowed coal companies to earn more money and hire fewer miners. This story, though, is only partially about jobs. It's really about history, the battle over what to remember and whether to remember it at all. Kenny King leads us up an uncleared path to the top of Blair Mountain. It's wintertime, no leaves on the trees, and at the top you can see for miles in each direction.
Okay, we're on the south crest of Blair Mountain. This would have been the defensive line here, where the guards and detectives, volunteers, whatever, came up here and dug in. There's several trenches over here, and we're shooting down at the miners as they were trying to make their way up White Stripes Branch there.
No one knows the exact details of what happened here in late August, early September 1921, but here's the basic story. For 5 days, around 10,000 coal miners took up arms against the private militias employed by West Virginia's Stone Mountain Mining Company. They were demanding the right to organize, to join unions.
From all the artifacts found here, there had to be hundreds of men up here. I mean, there's probably thousands of shell cases scattered in this area here.
As many as 100 men died in the fighting, and it got so bad that President Warren G. Harding sent a detachment of federal troops to crush the rebellion.
Oh, you better run, no. Somebody's calling you to run, no.
Now, none of this happened in a vacuum. Tension had been building up for years. Just a year before, union-busting mercenaries who worked for a private agency called Baldwin Feltz shot and killed the pro-union mayor of the nearby town of Matewan. The director John Sayles made a film about it in 1987. Anyway, at the time, most states had laws against organizing. It didn't help that President Harding's administration was decidedly anti-labor. The worry was the unions would bog down industry and put the brakes on America's rapid economic growth. Take a listen to this rare recording from Harding's 1920 acceptance speech at the Republican convention.
I want the wage earners to understand the problems, the anxieties, the obligations of management and capital.
The problem for the wage earners, at least those in Logan County, West Virginia, was they didn't have a whole lot of options. Here's Doug Estep, a local historian who runs tours of the area.
They had the Yellow Dog contract, which said that basically if you took a job at this mine, you could not associate with anyone with the union. You couldn't join. If you did, you were basically fired, blacklisted, and evicted, and probably beaten on your way out by the guards just for good measure. But yeah, that was standard procedure.
The coal companies owned your house. They paid you in credits that could only be spent on highly inflated food at the company-owned store. And if you complained about safety, you were fired. Their private security men from Baldwin Feltz would threaten, beat, and sometimes murder agitators, all with impunity. And so it all came to a head in late August 1921. The miners of Logan and Mingo counties had had enough. Back in the 1970s, a documentary called Even the Heavens Weep featured a few of the survivors of the battle, including Paul Maynard.
I don't know, there were thousands from around here, but they were coming in from Illinois, Pennsylvania, and Ohio, the miners was. And they told the government if they didn't open up Logan County that they was going to open it up themselves and blow it away.
Now, although the workers outnumbered the coal company guards, they were also outgunned.
The coal operators had machine guns, they had Tommy guns, a lot of high-powered rifles. They even had a small artillery piece up on one of the mountains here. We're not sure where, but it was a small U.S., ex-U.S. military field artillery piece. It's a 1.5-pounder, but it wasn't fired as far as we know. But that's what the miners were facing.
And after 5 days, the rebellion was crushed. Hundreds of rebels were tried for insurrection and treason. The legal fees bankrupted the United Mine Workers Union, and for the next decade, it almost disappeared. Every few weeks, Kenny Keene comes up here to the top of Blair Mountain with his metal detector to find spent bullet casings. More than a million rounds were fired in those 5 days in 1921, and every time he's up here, Kenny finds them.
Okay, I got one. Finally. That's a 351 SL.
2 years ago, Blair Mountain was entered into the National Register of Historic Places, and then, just a few months later, it was taken off by state officials. Lawyers hired by West Virginia's largest coal companies came up with a list of landowners who they said objected to the designation. And why would they object?
There's apparently a lot of money to be made by blowing this mountain up and taking the coal out from it.
That's Gordon Simmons. He's a labor historian who we'll hear more from in a moment. And what he's talking about is mountaintop removal. A lot of the land around Blair Mountain is owned by coal companies, including the biggest ones, Massey and Arch. For now, the state hasn't given permission to mine this immediate area, but judging by the number of tractors and heavy machines already deployed here, preservationists like Kenny King think it's just a matter of time.
They have already approved that area over there, 333 acres, for mountaintop removal.
Where we are standing right now, you fear that this will not exist if this is no longer designated as a National Historic Site.
It'll be just a flat, grassy field.
Kenny believes this is hallowed ground, like Gettysburg or the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, places where America's history was forever changed. But he's had a hard time making that case to the folks in Logan County, a place where every fourth person is out of work. At the Gomart gas station about 4 miles from the mountain, mine workers stop by to grab pizza and hot dogs before heading off to the night shift. There are only about 16,000 miners left in West Virginia today. Mountaintop removal doesn't require as much manpower as underground mining. These are coveted jobs. They pay well. And so, for the most part, miners are more interested in seeing the economy grow rather than preserving what they see as just another mountain. A 22-year-old we met named Jordan summed up the consensus view around here.
We got to mine the coal to make the money, period. That's all they are to it. Would you rather see trash up there, refrigerators dumped off on the side of the road, dishwashers, babies, diapers laying on the side of the road, or would you rather see it stripped off, cleaned up, park benches on with a big plaque commemorating the battle? My dad was a strip miner, my grandfather was, my dad was a deep miner also. Been around my whole life, it's all I know and that's all I will ever do.
About a 90-minute drive from Logan, at the ornate State Capitol building in Charleston, Gordon Simmons, the labor historian, has been part of a group trying to get Blair Mountain back onto the National Register. He says the struggle isn't only about jobs and mining rights, it's also about whether to remember Blair Mountain or to sweep it under the rug.
It shows in 1921, for example, that the political establishment of the state of West Virginia was wholly controlled by coal interests, so much so that the only way to have any effective opposition was to engage in armed insurrection. And it shows currently, when the historic designation got withdrawn, that things haven't changed that dramatically, that the long arm of King Coal can't reach into the state government and make things happen in its favor.
Just this week, West Virginia's Historic Preservation Office started the process to get Blair Mountain back onto the National Register. Landowners have until April 1st to file objections. Unless more than half of them do object, the application heads back to the federal government for consideration.
This is a political fight. This is a social fight. It's a fight about our history, our heritage, our culture. It's a fight about what kind of society West Virginia is going to be going forward and what it has been in its past.
The irony about Blair Mountain is that it nearly destroyed the Union. It would take 15 years until the National Labor Relations Act to help revive it. But Blair Mountain was a pivotal moment, and if it does finally get a spot on the historic register, there's a good chance the story of what happened there will also find a more prominent spot in America's collective memory.
I used to be a drill man down at Old Parley, drilling through slate and sand rock till it got the best of me. Dog dust has almost killed me. It's turned me out in the rain. Sawdust has settled on my lungs and causes me constant pain.
And you can see photos of Blair Mountain and more at our website, npr.org. Our story was produced by Lauren Silverman.
For drilling is a job I love, yes, I will repeat. It's kill to fellow workers.
Monroe Beachy doesn't particularly stand out in his community of Sugar Creek, Ohio. He's 77 years old.
A little under 6 feet tall, short gray, white hair. He's your typical Amishman with a beard and suspenders and that type of thing.
That's Beverly Keller. She's the editor of The Budget in Sugar Creek. It's the national newspaper that covers the Amish community. About a year ago, she was on her way to the office.
It was a Monday, and actually on my way to work, I saw this sign on the front of A&M Investments that said closed due to investigation. And I scratched my head and I said, there's got to be something to this.
A&M Investments stands for Amish and Mennonite Investments. It was run by Monroe Beachy. So Beverly started calling around to see what was going on. And what was happening was that Monroe Beachy, a pillar of the Amish community, was under investigation by the Securities and Exchange Commission, under investigation for fraud. And the news hit Northwest Ohio fast.
$33 million from investors between...
And what is described as a case involving a multi-million dollar fraudulent offering scheme.
It all came crashing down after the broker filed for bankruptcy.
Now, like most Amish men, Monroe Beachy has an eighth grade education. Back in the 1980s, he took a few classes at H&R Block and came to be regarded as a kind of financial guru for the community.
He was, you know, a very reputable man. He was someone you went to, you know, for financial questions and answers. I mean, you have to understand, he was a very trusted man in this community.
And in the late 1980s, he started up an investment fund for his fellow Amish, and his record was great.
He was paying 5, 6, 7, 8%, and that's not something you're going to get at the bank.
Every month, Monroe Beachy would walk through the village, handing people handwritten statements.
Saying, hey, you earned this much. Yay, congratulations. And in reality, he wasn't earning that.
Over the next two decades, Amish folks in 29 states handed Monroe Beachy $33 million.
As silly as that sounds to us, that you would put money in an envelope and mail it, they did.
Beachy took their money and put it into junk bonds and internet schemes. But it turns out his investment never made any profit. In fact, the fund was hemorrhaging money. It was a Ponzi scheme, and there was something else.
Monroe Beachy was also the treasurer for a group known as the Amish Helping Fund. Now, the Amish Helping Fund could be considered a bank in and of itself.
As Beverly explains, Monroe Beachy was seen by his fellow Amish as a Warren Buffett-type figure with the power of Timothy Geithner and the methods of Bernie Madoff. When the SEC finally caught up with him, they soon figured out he had almost nothing to show for.
And really, his only assets were his horse and buggy and harnesses.
But to the community, his biggest sin wasn't ripping people off, but filing for bankruptcy rather than working it out within the Amish legal system. So last December, Monroe Beachy filed a motion in federal court to have his bankruptcy rescinded. The SEC is currently challenging it, and Beverly Keller is still following the story for the Budget newspaper in Sugar Creek, Ohio. Now, the occasional Amish Ponzi scheme notwithstanding, most crime in America has been on a steady decline since the 1990s, and few petty crimes have declined faster than pickpocketing. And while he's not necessarily pining for its return, writer Joe Cohane says that's kind of a shame.
It's a very human crime, I would say, in the sense that you're man-to-man.
Joe wrote about the decline of pickpocketing for Slate magazine.
There's no real advantage in terms of physicality or weaponry, and you just outsmart your victim.
Take this scene, Joe says, from the caper Ocean's 11.
You think we need one more?
George Clooney is assembling his 11-man team for a casino heist.
All right, we'll get one more.
His 11th is Matt Damon.
And he's riding the CTA in Chicago, riding the L train.
George Clooney is watching. Damon maneuvers close to a passenger.
It looks like he has money. He's a pretty prime mark for a pickpocket.
They're riding along, and suddenly the train lurches.
Damon bumps into him, and then just shoots his hand into the guy's jacket pocket.
And it seems like a successful pick.
He gets off the train, and moments later he reaches into his pocket to try to find the wallet, and there's a card from Danny Ocean, who's George Clooney's character. And the implication is that Clooney is twice the pickpocket Damon is, because he's defeated this master pickpocket without him ever even seeing him on the train.
Hello, Linus. Whose is this?
Now, this type of pickpocketing, Joe Cohane says, doesn't happen anymore. It requires skills that modern criminals just don't have.
Poise. You need someone whose hand's not going to shake, who's going to have the patience, number one, to develop the skills required, but number two, have the patience to just wait and look for the proper mark. They need to be able to read humanity. They need to be able to predict how certain people are going to respond if they do catch them pickpocketing. They need to predict patterns of behavior that'll allow people to become bigger targets for pickpocketing.
Thing is, just 20 years ago, American cities were rife with pickpockets. In 1990, in New York alone, there were over 23,000 cases reported.
It amounted to $10 million in losses. Now, 5 years later, the number of reported incidents fell by half. And by around 2000, there were less than 5,000 reported pickpocketing incidents. Today, the NYPD doesn't even track those numbers at all. They're just lumped in with larceny.
It's the same story in a lot of other major U.S. cities. And that's partly because no one teaches pickpocketing anymore. There's no longer a system of apprenticeship. And there used to be one. Older pickpockets, called wires, would teach younger ones the craft.
Each wire would be good enough that he started training five pickpockets underneath him, and then they would train five, and they would train five, and it would just keep the system going. It used to happen a lot more in New York. You would have organized pickpocketing schools in New York.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is O.T., and I'm a retired pickpocket.
That's Sherman O.T. Powell speaking to an audience at The Moth, a storytelling organization in New York. When we reached him at his home in Harlem this week, he described training at a pickpocketing school in 1969 in a room full of dressed mannequins.
They would have these bells on them, and so your hand had to be light enough to lift this wallet and yet not let the bell ring. Like my teacher used to say, you had to be like a pianist.
O.T. trained for 3 months. Then he hit the streets.
You dressed in a suit or nice casual clothes. You look clean cut.
On a good day, he could make $2,000.
My toughest picks were when I started going to Macy's. They had these revolving doors. And I mean, going through that door and opening up a woman's pocket, we're getting the wallet, then closing it back. And as she's going into the store, you're just revolving, going right back out to the street and hailing the taxi.
O.T. says he couldn't do that kind of work today, even if he wanted to. Pickpockets everywhere now face stepped-up surveillance and cameras, and the wide use of debit cards hasn't helped.
When people stopped carrying money, that was the beginning of the end of the pickpocketers.
Not to mention, he says, it's a lot easier for criminals to just use a weapon.
Pickpockets don't have no respect for thugs or robbers. You know, we consider them, you know, ancient, you know, prehistoric. We feel that anybody can stick a gun in a person's face and just... That's not hard to do, but to take a person's money and them not knowing it's gone, that's the art of it. That's the cleverness of it.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, is it okay to be nostalgic for a crime? Probably not. You know, it's probably good that people aren't being robbed anymore or with the frequency that they were before. But your tendency, your nostalgic tendency is to mourn for the loss of something that requires skill and style and panache.
You're either in or you're out right now.
And in a lot of ways, this is the way that pickpockets have been viewed, you know, for age eternal.
That's the best lift I've seen you make yet.
Joe Cohane, his story on the lost art of pickpocketing appeared in Slate magazine. Sherman O.T. Powell is writing an autobiography. His story first aired on the Moth Radio Hour, presented by PRX. You can find it and others at themoth.org.
A little less conversation, a little more action, please. All this aggravation ain't satisfaction in me. A little more bite, a little less bark. A little less fight, a little more spark. Close your mouth and open up your heart, and baby, satisfy me.
Every March, the beautiful people like Madonna and Diddy and Karl Lagerfeld, I don't know if he goes, but the beautiful people, they head down to Miami to join the gods of electronic dance music. And there, they float in and out of dance clubs to hear some of the best DJs in the world practice their trade. They come to Miami in March to check out two huge electronic music festivals, the Winter Music Conference and the Ultra Music Festival. The festival doesn't start till later this month, but the conference, which is a little like the Cannes Film Festival of electronica, kicks off Tuesday. And Sammy Yenigun, a music producer here at NPR who covers dance and electronic music, is with us for a preview of what we can expect. Sammy, can we just dance here in the studio?
Hey, Guy, if you think you can keep up with
me,
man, I'm down.
All right, let's go. All right, let's clear one thing up, Sammy. Dance, techno, electronic music, this is mainstream music in virtually every country in the world except here in the United States. It's not played on the radio. Why do you think that is?
Well, I mean, it's one of the great mysteries, right? Because this music started in Chicago and Detroit. And, you know, in some respect, New York City. Short answer, I don't know. Long answer, I think it might have something to do with kind of how it started. It started in the minority gay black communities of this country. And when it went overseas, it was placed in a new context. And it was allowed to kind of hit the mainstream and hit the top of the charts. And that was something that never really caught on here. I mean, you see music coming from minority groups like hip-hop, for example.
Right.
It's still just hitting the mainstream
in a real way now. I mean, it's one of the biggest parts of the music.
Now it is. It's been around since the 80s. I mean, you know, it took a long time for people to start accepting that it was something that could be a mainstream success.
And I have to say, I love this music, but it took me a while to get into it, and it had a lot to do with the 3 years that I spent as a reporter in Berlin. I talk to people, and they say, you know, to me it sounds like the same thing, the same beat or the same loop over and over again. You must hear that.
Yeah, no, I hear that. I mean, and at a very basic level, house music and techno music, the structure of it is this 4-4 structure that has a bass kick on every beat of the measure, right? Mm-hmm. So there is that basic template for all of these songs. Now,
right.
Within that, there's tons of variation and tons of different rhythms and sounds. You know, no two waltzes are the same.
Right.
So I want you to listen to this this producer named Michel Kleiss.
And he's going to be featured at the Winter Music Conference?
He will be at the Winter Music Conference, yeah.
All right, let's hear him.
So he's from Switzerland, and this guy kind of has a funny story. He was a practicing psychologist.
Wow.
Until he broke his leg playing basketball. And so he was stuck at home for 3 months and got a little cabin fever and decided to start making music.
Hmm.
After a while, he developed this sound with all these Latin samples that he uses in a lot of his songs. And then he had this smash hit song called La Mezcla. And ever since, he's been producing these Latin house tracks that have been really big around the world. This track is called Litoral.
I love this. This is great.
Yeah.
It's a lot of fun.
Yeah. I mean, to me, this song screams summer. And I'm curious to see how it's received because these are the festivals that kind of determine what the big summer dance tracks are going to be.
And when you say the big dance tracks of the summer, this is not going to be music played on commercial radio in the U.S., but it is going to be played on the radio in Europe, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's got much better chance of being on commercial radio in Europe than here. But with that being said, I mean, this music is kind of on our mainstream radio. You look at the top of the charts, right? You got people like the Black Eyed Peas, who, by the way, Will.i.am is performing at Ultra.
And he was actually on our show a few months ago. This is one of the biggest bands in the world.
Right. He's got the French producer David Guetta, who's also a big draw at Ultra Music Festival, who produced their big hit, I Got a Feeling.
And Sammy, I gotta say, like it or not, this song spent like 10 weeks or something like that at number one on the Billboard charts last year.
Yeah, that's right.
Huge song.
It was huge. I mean, and there's other things. I mean, you listen to Kesha or Britney Spears or any of these chart toppers, they have this 4-4 structure with an electronic toolkit making these songs. I mean, this is electronic music in its kind of most diluted form.
I'm talking with NPR music producer Sammy Yenigan about some of the electronic artists who will be at the Winter Music Conference and the Ultra Music Festival in Miami this month. Sammy, who is producing that, you know, that really exciting new stuff right now? Who is the biggest DJ in the world right now?
Well, the biggest DJ in the world, I mean, that's a tough one. DJ Mag puts out a
DJ Magazine.
DJ Magazine puts out a list of the top 100 DJs in the world every year, and DJ Armin van Buuren has been at the top of that list for 4 years running.
Right.
But this year at Ultra, this guy Tiesto is headlining, and he can sell out stadiums all over the world. I mean, he's huge. This is music that builds humongous amounts of tension in something called the build and then releases all of this tension in what's called the drop.
Okay, so understandably, a lot of people might hear it and say, it's impenetrable. You know, it's not accessible. It's not easy for somebody to get right into it.
Well, there's this stigma attached to dance music that somehow it's anti-intellectual. It's not music that's just made by party animals. I mean, sure, people are dancing at these festivals, mm-hmm. but it takes brains to make a track that gets people moving.
Right.
One thing I always try to tell people who haven't listened to much of this type of music is put on a pair of really good headphones and pay attention to the timbres of the sounds themselves. I mean, there's this record label in San Francisco right now called Dirty Bird, and they've been putting out some of my favorite music recently. The artists on it use really interesting sounds, twisting samples in really bizarre ways that have dark, grimy kind of moods to them. Take a listen to this sample, guy, and see if you can recognize where it's from.
All right. I do know that, I believe. And I say this only because we do so much music on the show, because otherwise I wouldn't know it. That's Snoop Dogg
and Pharrell. Snoop Dogg and Pharrell. Drop it like it's hot. You're exactly right. Now Justin Martin has taken these mouth pops and clicks from the original, and he's rearranged them to make this up-tempo groover. Mm. Now, he's surrounded these sounds with these little details, like the hissing and that chubby, wet bass kick. And getting these sounds right is really difficult to do. This is music that doesn't need to be heard at a club or a festival. Mm. I mean, you can listen to it in a car or in your headphones in your room at home, but it does work well in a party setting.
So I suppose at this conference, the Winter Music Conference, which kicks off on Tuesday, is that right?
That's right.
I guess I'll be talking about the future, I mean, because I always do that at these conferences. What is the future? I mean, what are they going to be saying?
Well, genres like techno and house have been around since the 80s, but this type of music called dubstep is a relative newcomer to the world of dance music. It's really hot right now. These songs have a much slower tempo, but as you'll hear, that doesn't really take any of the energy away from them. This is a new track by an artist called Nero. A couple days ago, this was called the hottest record in the world by BBC Radio 1 show host Zain Lowe.
And Zain Lowe, I should admit, he's hugely influential in the British music scene.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he works for Radio 1, and they're kind of the source for a lot of this music, a lot of dance and electronic music. I mean, it's just way bigger over there.
Right.
But if we have enough of these conversations, maybe we can do something.
Let's do it, man. Let's go.
Right.
You know what? I'm taking the headphones off. Let's go out.
Let's go clubbing
right now, Sammy.
All right.
That's Sammy Yenigun. He's a music producer at NPR. He specializes in dance and electronic music. Sammy, thanks so much for popping by and giving us a preview of the Winter Music Conference in Miami.
Thank you, Guy. Appreciate it.
And if you want to take a closer listen to any of these tracks, check out our website, nprmusic.org. Thanks for listening to this edition of Weekends on All Things Considered. The program this week was directed by Petra Mayer and produced by Phil Harrell, Kenya Young, Lauren Silverman, Lily Percy, Brent Bachman, and Jessica Deal. Daniel Shukin is our technical director. Our intern is Megan Kane. Mathoni Maturi is filling in for Rick Holter as our editor. Our senior producer is Matt Martinez. I'm Guy Raz. We're back next Sunday with the best of Weekends on All Things Considered. And remember, you can hear the full version of this program on your local public radio station each Saturday and Sunday afternoon.